right, so we're in GoTo.
Hey.
Aarhus.
Hey, Charles.
How you doing, man?
I'm good.
It's been way too long since I've seen you. Last time was Chicago.
That's true. And since then, I've been traveling Europe to teach.
Excellent. Haskell, I assume?
Haskell, C#, Link.
Excellent. And of course, Gilad Braca joins us. Sort of a surprise. We weren't expecting you here.
No one ever expects the Spanish Inquisition.
But Gilad, yeah, what are you doing in Aarhus?
Well, and in Aarhus, I visit Aarhus rather frequently these days because this is DART Supreme headquarters, and so I'm here. This is since June, the third time I've been here. So yeah, basically, a large part of our group is here. Lars is here, so that's why the real decisions happen here. And those of us who want to have some small bit of influence need to come
to the headquarters.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So listen, you guys, since we have two language designers sitting in front, I've been thinking recently about, you know, what's the state of programming language design? Is the art and craft of programming language design dead? We don't seem to see anything really new. Now, you may say that DART represents something very new, and yes, it does, but there still seems to be this rehashing of the same concepts over and over and over again. Where's the next generation?
Well, Charles, I there's two kind of, you know, older, bold guys sitting here, you know, talking about language design, so, but we're not dead, you know, we're still kind of full of life.
Yeah.
So I don't think the programming language design is dead. If I would phrase it like this, is that programming has certain fundamental abstractions, so that's what you see kind of, you know, constantly reappearing, and you're trying to combine them in different ways. It's just like when you're cooking, there are certain ingredients, and you're trying to create the perfect meal by, you know, carefully combining these ingredients. And I would say that DART is actually taking some rather revolutionary ideas, according to the programming language community, with respect to its type system. Wouldn't you say that, you know, you're
revolutionary? I mean, these ideas have been around for decades. Yes. But yes, they're ideas that have not hit the mainstream in any way yet. So there's a lot of stuff that is only hitting the mainstream that is decades old. You know, actors are have become hot and widely known only in the past few years. It's an idea that really dates to 1972 when people were programming with flint tools. And so it takes a long time. The limitation here isn't the technology, the limitation is the people. And people have a deep attachment to how they program. It's a cultural artifact in a way, like natural language. And people hate to change it. And so it moves as fast as the people will let it, which is very, very slowly. So the core ideas, yeah, they've all been around for a long time. I don't think there are new core ideas, really. But a lot of those ideas were very good, but didn't catch on for all kinds of reasons. And eventually, you know, good will triumph.
So that's an interesting thing. Like, some people say you should not listen to the hit parade, you know, now. You should wait, you know, 10 years, you know, and then listen to the golden oldies when, you know, the good songs, like, have shifted like the cream on the milk.
Yeah.
Do you believe that there's something like that for ideas in programming language as well, that you cannot judge right now when somebody comes up with a new idea whether it's really a good idea?
Well, first of all, I can certainly judge right now.
Yes,
I could always judge.
Yeah.
Right? But I think the really good ideas, they've been around so long that you can judge. You can look back a long time. But you need judgment, which is in short supply. To some extent, I don't think that you want to wait 10 years. The whole advantage is from taking good stuff. You have to make the judgment if it's really ready for prime time in your context. Are the implementations mature enough? Is the whole ecosystem there? Do you need that much of an ecosystem? You know, everybody has their own considerations, right? There are legitimate reasons for businesses and stuff to be a little conservative. They're usually far too conservative because they usually can't find qualified people to make those decisions. And if they do have them, they're outnumbered by unqualified people who will override them. But I don't think that you want to, you know, it's not like when a new car comes out, you want to wait for two model years to be sure they debug it. None of these cars are really new. They're really just reshuffled.
And so let's kind of go back to an idea that you mentioned, an old idea of actors.
Mm-hmm.
Why do you think it took so long for that idea to blossom, and why is it now so hot?
Well, partly because the need for it, the need for really massive amounts of independent, you know, actors, concurrent threads is an overloaded word, but threads of control has become more and more pronounced. There's more. We've reached a point where it's harder to make the hardware run faster, so we finally started to focus on more units of hardware and things like that, and we'll see more and more of that. So this is a vision both for hardware and, you know, the vision was driven by Carl Hewitt's insight into really fundamental things, but very few people get that sort of thing. It's really, you know, you have to hold, you know, a knife to their throat and say, the world is changing, you'd better get with the program. And so I think that one was exceptionally far-sighted and consequently takes even longer to catch on. But I don't think it's different from other ideas. It just, you have to have the right constellation. Basically, you have to reach a point where people don't have another choice. Because if they have a choice, they won't change. They just, change is painful. People don't like that.
Yeah, by the way, there's a great interview with Carl Hewitt on Channel 9 that we did a while back. So if you want to really kind of, you know, hear from the inventor of actors himself, you know, what actors are, you know, you can go there. So does DART have any kind of special support for actors? Like they, you have this isolates, right?
Right.
Are they kind of influenced by actors?
So isolates are very much influenced by actors. Independent threads of control with separate heaps and stacks and such. So they communicate via message passing. So in some sense, the essence of actors is there. Now, details, you know, vary, but we don't have any multi-threading in the sense of shared state concurrency. So we're actually surprisingly pure there. Not necessarily because, you know, I may be a purist, but the project as a whole is very much not so, but we are constrained by the platform we're targeting, which really doesn't have the means of doing anything else very well. So yeah, it's very, very actor-like in that respect.
And so one of the things that, like, you know, a lot of people say when they talk about concurrency is they talk about immutability. But I think with actors, they are, as you said, right, they have their own stack. So they are mutable, but the changes are isolated. So they are locally mutable.
Right. And this is not the pure actor model in the sense of all these things being functional. These are basically conventional single-threaded programs that communicate via message passing. And that's actually the form that you've largely seen take off in many places, which is fine, which does mean that in some sense there is state somewhere in the model and so forth, and no doubt it can get you, but much less than in a shared state, you know, closely coupled, multi-threaded sense.
And so one of the things, like, you know, if you look in the DART, inside the kind of implementation of the DART VM, You have this trick where you kind of, you know, in order to speed up loading of programs, where you can kind of, you know, do like a core dump and then read back the
snapshot.
The snapshot, yes.
Right.
Can you enlighten us a little bit about that? Is that also like an old idea? If you look at LaTeX, you know, Tech does the same thing. It's like a primitive form of jitting in some sense.
Well, the snapshotting is really if you go back, small talk, right? So this is sort of a lobotomized small talk image, very lobotomized. Yes. It's much more restrictive and much more narrowly focused than a small talk image, which really captures all your state and so forth. But the idea is the same, that you can bring back these things if you know, very fast, if you save them as a unit, as opposed to, say, serializing something and then chasing graphs and things like that. And startup time is a big problem on the web and growing bigger as more ambitious projects get on the web, and at the same time the web gets on less ambitious machinery like phones. Those two trends do not do well in terms of startup time. And so this is a technique that can be used to, you know, if not, it has other advantages, but right now that's really the point of it. And of course, to this works with a Dart VM, And so, you know, there's more limited scope where we can rely on this, but it is a technique. It's a technique that should have been used for this purpose many years ago, you know, in the Java TM world, right? Startup is a notorious problem, and you would think that this idea would have occurred to someone, and someone might have brought it up, and something might be done about it. And except for something being done about it, you might be right. But bottom line is, you have to act on it, you have to engineer it, and we're in the process of doing that. But the idea is that you can get things can start up a lot faster, especially on the web. You have this problem that people expect to serve basically source code.
Yep.
So you have the extra overhead of parsing this stuff, right? There's no really good intermediate form, and so the snapshot kind of takes that role.
But I always wondered, I mean, I really like, you know, that should be obvious, that I like this idea, but it always puzzles me, why do we kind of separate the code and the state of a running program, and then now we have to kind of, as you say, serialize it, and why don't we just treat, you know, a program, a running program, as one unit that, you know, you save and then, you know, you restart, or even to distribute your code? I ever have to write something that writes data to a file and reads it back? Why can't we just persist the binary image?
I know you said this deliberately because you want to get me started. And so this is it's a double-edged sword, right? Smalltalk has been doing this for some decades now.
Yeah, but and don't they say that you can take a Smalltalk image from 20 years ago and just push the button and run it?
Probably, yeah. You can take a Newspeak image running on Windows with certain native Windows open and take it to a Mac and open and have those windows reopen with the same contents, with the debugger open at the same time. Yeah, it has something to recommend it. On the other hand, and it starts up pretty damn fast and so forth. So there's a lot of good things about this. There are downsides because, especially when you're developing, right, your state can go wrong, can get corrupted, and having your program and state kind of intermingled in this way makes it very hard to tease them apart. So one of the reasons, I mean, the reasons are debated to death as to why Smalltalk did not take over the world as it should have, is that deployment was sort of a bit of a complicated story here, because in fact, the typical Smalltalk development process, you have this wonderful development environment and this IDE travels with your application, with your state, etc., everywhere. And separating them is difficult, which is why, you know, it can be done differently. Your language has to have a very clean notion that separates program from state, right? It has to be modular in a way that you can actually understand what your program is independent of the state, and then it's very easy to separate. That's what we do in Newspeak, for example. But as a development tool, it has pros and cons, and there are intermediate versions of this that, you know, Smalltalks that didn't use a pure image like Strongtalk. But it's not, you know, all you need is for your program during development to screw up your image once and go through the effort of recovering from that to realize that, well, there's something to be said for the stupid old files and which completely keep the two separate. So ideally, you want to combine the advantages.
Yes, yeah. But even when, you know, we all have had, like, you know, our mail reader doesn't open because, you know, your mail file is corrupt or something like. So is that really kind of tied to the fact that you have, like, code and data together, or?
Well, I think it makes it a lot worse, right? Okay. Obviously, your program, your actual application, will run on some data, and I'm of the view that they should be viewed. A program should be viewed as data. It should be separable. It shouldn't depend on data, but it should be viewed as data so that you can synchronize programs the same way you synchronize your address book. I've said this on Channel 9 before, right? You just want to have this. The same mechanism could serve as your update mechanism, and, you know, it works very nicely. Once you have that kind of model, all kinds of things, reflection, etc., everything works out better because it's, by design, the program is easier to manipulate. It's designed to work as data. So we should move in that direction, and eventually we will. It's just another one of those things that takes decades, and any imperfect realization has flaws that, you know, you can argue against. Mm-hmm. Certainly, Smalltalk images are far from perfect and a mixed blessing in a way.
And so we talked about before about your ideas of, you know, like components for the web and so on. And one thing that I would like to kind of, you know, talk a little bit about now is like schema versioning. A lot of people, that seems to be a hard problem that a lot of developers run into. Now, sometimes I say, well, if you don't have a schema in the first place, if you have a dynamically typed language, then that problem is, you know, it might still exist, but it's a lot less in your face because you don't have to change the types. What is your opinion about, or how do you deal with like schema changes and versioning?
Well, I think that it is a very hard problem. And again, work has been done for this on decades. Yes. Probably the Lispers have done the most work on it, right? It is hard. Types only make it harder, which is true of many things. And you end up, in the end, there is a schema even if there is no type. And so add things, you remove things, and you need to have, someone has to specify how these things, you migrate from one version of the schema to another. And there have been schemes where you can annotate things and say, okay, here's how I map from version so-and-so. And the problem is that these changes themselves may have side effects or rely on the old schema or the new. So it gets rather tricky. I think that just more attention should be paid to it, because what we do in practice are convoluted workarounds of all kinds that still hit people in the face. And nobody's willing to invest the effort to do it right. And if you try to do it right without really going all the way, you're going to fall on your face. So I think there needs to be more research on this, more projects that try to do it right, that actually address the issue of how data migrates. Now that we have large bodies of data, your data is often out in the cloud somewhere. In a way, that's sort of easier, because there is some authority or server or whatever who can deal with this and has the resources and time and obligation to upgrade your data, right? You basically want your program and data to upgrade. You don't want to find old dusty decks somewhere from years ago, right? And now we're in a connected world, so it's really a question of immediately upgrading everything rather than worrying about many layers. So that can help.
And so to kind of tie it back to Dart, so one of the things that I like about Go is the way the notion of interfaces in Go. Mm-hmm. Now Dart has no interfaces anymore. I learned.
What's
the deal there? Explain.
Okay, so the concept of interface is still very important in Dart. For example, classes can implement other things, which what you don't have anymore is a syntactic concept of an interface, a declaration that's called an interface, because we found it was redundant. One of the things that we've done right is in Dart, the type system, optional though it is completely interface-based, right? It only matters what interface an object implements. It doesn't matter what particular class it was. There's no way for you to describe a type and say that this ties you to a particular implementation, except for a few places like numbers and booleans because we're more concerned with being efficient, and it's very, very rare that anyone needs to override them. So given that, we then realized that, now you can actually implement another class, which means you won't extend it, you won't inherit its representation or its implementation, but we'll say that you conform to that type, as it were. And once you have that, you realize that you can replace interfaces with abstract classes. And in fact, this solved a whole slew of ugly problems, like what are the values of default parameters in an interface declaration, or where do we put static methods in an interface declaration, all kinds of things like that. So we got rid of the declarations, but you still have this notion of an interface, because that's really what you're programming to, and in fact, you can implement another class. So there's still an implements clause on classes, even though there isn't an interface declaration. And this has simplified a lot of stuff. It works very nicely. This is probably one of the best things that has happened to Dart in the past few months.
And doesn't that introduce problems with multiple inheritance? Because now, doesn't your class have now multiple supertypes?
It has changed absolutely nothing because the problem with multiple inheritance is multiple implementation inheritance, right? Multiple classification, which is what interfaces give you, is not a problem because you don't have to resolve, you know, you don't have to choose between one thing or another. And so they behave exactly as multiple, implementing multiple interfaces do in all the languages that people are used to. So it really didn't complicate that at all.
And do you then have something like traits where you can inherit implementation but not types?
Well, we have right now we have just vanilla single inheritance. We're very conservative. We are going to have mix-ins. Details to be nailed down. I mean, there is a proposal and all, but you know, until it's, you know, at some point we're actually we're aiming for what we call M1, which is an unspecified thing at an unspecified time, because we don't like to make commitments. But it basically is a version where we're saying pretty much language will not have breaking changes anymore. And after that, we may add things, and mix-ins are expected to be an addition that will not break existing stuff. And so it's out there, but not for immediate use. Charles?
I have a question.
Okay.
So that's actually an interesting point. As language designers, when do you know it's time to stop breaking changes? I mean, don't you have to wait for there to be relatively substantial amount of use in the real world under various scenarios you might not have thought about?
Well, we don't know. The real world doesn't operate that way. If you waited to do things until you knew, there were creatures who took that approach. They're endangered in the rainforest in Uganda, the chimpanzees and the mountain gorillas, because they took the conservative approach and stayed where they were. So you have to take a bit of a risk, but you know, we're Dart is not a radical language. We are not testing out new concepts on people, for the most part. And so we have a fair idea of what's likely to work, and we've built a fair amount of code ourselves. And so there's no death penalty if we're wrong. So, you know, if somehow we screwed up and there might be some adjustments, they'll come very early. But by and large, we have a sense that things are in pretty good shape. And again, these are concepts that are mostly known from a bunch of languages, and you know, they're just put together in a nice way that'll work on the web.
So I want to also talk about the kind of control flow aspects of Dart, but one more question about the type system. So when you have this, you know, like optional typing system, do you have any concept of downcast, and what does that mean, and how do you kind of check type compatibility when you're doing a cast?
Right. So, in fact, and with some reluctance, there is now a cast operator called as.
And that sounds familiar. Where did you get that syntax from?
I don't know why. I can't imagine where. No comment. So the idea is basically, you know, it wasn't essential. You could do we had a equivalent of an instance of test, which was called is. And that really, you can ask where we got that one from. But you could express what you wanted before. This just is sort of a convenient shorthand for that. And it's a dynamic test. Now, what is it that is being tested here?
Yes. Yeah.
So we have a number of relations defined in the type system. And there is assignable, if you will, which is a very loose relationship. And there's subtype, which is a slightly tighter relationship, which is still pretty loose by most people's standards, right? And subtype is what we test. So, you know, more or less what you'd expect. There's a nominal declaration relationship between the classes. And when you get to generics, we have our famous patented covariant scheme. No, it isn't patented, actually. Oh, just in case you
it's
were
unsafe.
Worried. Yeah.
But very useful.
Yeah, and so you basically do that comparison at runtime. Now, again, it's not a sound system, so there's a limit to what this will guarantee you, right? You can still test something like if is it a list of int, and under certain circumstances it'll certainly be a list, but might not be a list. Not everything in it might really be an int, because I could get into the scenarios where this can happen. In practice, this actually works for people and meets their expectations rather well. And the only worry I have about this casting is that it'll get overused, because people don't like to have type warnings, so they might be tempted to use it to satisfy the type checker, and Dart is very much against this idea of having to battle the type checker. If you really care about that, yeah, the type annotations can be adjusted or something, but this thing actually has a runtime cost, it happens, and so you shouldn't use it for that. But it's there. Again, people felt a need for this shorthand, and so, you know, we didn't think it was necessary in the beginning, and we added it.
But ultimately, the type system is nominal. So you, when you're doing like subtype checks and so on, that's a nominal check, or do you have like structural?
Well, so function types are essentially structural, right? And there's a structural element to the generic types as well, right? So it's those things tend to be that way even in the strictest type systems, right?
Well, but it's always kind of subtle, right? Because for example, in Haskell, you do have nominal and structural. Well, there's no subtyping, but type equivalence. But there, in a recursive type, there always has to be a nominal type to kind of break the loop. So, and I don't know if your kind of function types can be recursive. Can you define like, you know, x equals x arrow x?
So the nominal types do save you from getting going, you know, nuts for a long, long time. So yeah, it's primarily nominal, but there is structural. The other thing is, of course, they're very, very loose. The functional types are almost anything goes, really, because the parameters have to be assignable, which means they're on an inheritance chain. But it doesn't matter on which side, so you can upcast or downcast on them, and we don't complain. And the same for the return type. And there are, because we have optional parameters, there are some more constraints, because we do want the arity to match up, unlike JavaScript. We don't want extra parameters floating about or less parameters. If you have named parameters, we want the names to be there, things like that. So there are a bunch of slightly non-standard but fairly obvious constraints to make sure that these things can be called.
So if you insist on the right number of parameters, can you overload on method names or?
We don't.
Or overload. Like overload on arity? Sorry.
We do not overload on arity. You basically have one method with this name, and it could have optional stuff and so forth. But no, we don't do arity-based overloading or any overloading.
Yeah, because I think like type-based overloading, and you've written the Java language spec. I mean, that is the kind of most hairy part of most language definitions.
The great thing about type-based overloading is it gives employment to people like me. But other than that, it has no redeeming qualities. So yeah, type-based overloading is truly evil. Arity-based overloading is actually pretty harmless.
Yeah.
It just, you know, doesn't really fit that well, and especially once you, if you do that, you really want to ensure that everything has required parameters, because otherwise you're again up in deep water, because now you can't tell what you're doing. And given that we have optional positional parameters now, which is just coming in. As well as optional name parameters, you really don't want to get into the arity business as well.
One of the reasons I think that people, where you have to use, well, at least in like Java or C#, where you have to use type-based overloading, is for constructors, because you know there you cannot change the name. So if you want to have different constructors, you have no choice.
Well, it turns out you do.
Okay, good, great.
Right. So there are several choices. Of course, we're not trying to be, in Dart, we're very conservative, so we do have constructors. The real good choices don't have, you know, just don't do it. You don't need constructors. You can just have regular, you know, methods on appropriate factory objects and so forth, like we do, say, in Newspeak. But given that we wanted that familiar, warm, fuzzy feeling, which people really appreciate about Dart, there are constructors. But we've fixed much of the things that are broken about constructors. So we have named constructors. So you can, if you have a class called C, and the constructor, you can have a constructor called C, but you can also have a constructor C.foo. And so you can then have additional constructors that are different. And this actually makes things both more readable and solves that particular problem. The constructors also in Dart solve other problems, because we have factory constructors, which don't really have to allocate an instance of that same class. They can pick up things from a cache or call something else.
Okay, so no dependency injection needed. That's built in,
or you can, to some extent, right? Depending how fancy you want to get, but it solves a lot of those scenarios. Yeah,
yeah. Because So that's now I can, this just occurs to me. If you get rid of interfaces, and can you still create an instance of an abstract class? Or like, well, like.
Can, well, for, it depends what can means.
Oh, yes. Here we have the language lawyers.
Yeah.
Shoot, may.
Yeah, right. So, basically, because you mention a class name in instances are created at bottom by new, but new can be that new may not actually create a new thing, right? You can. We also have these redirecting constructors, which lets you, you know, the thing can create something else, right? So the fact you say new C doesn't mean you have to get a C, right? So you can always fix it by by modifying that thing. Then that reduces the need for dependency injection. And if it's an abstract class, we will warn you about that. And in fact, we change it so we'll give you a runtime error if you try to instantiate it, unless it's one of these factories, because then, in fact, that's what happens with you use it as an interface. You call an abstract class, and there's real implementation classes somewhere, which if you say new foo and foo is abstract, but if it's a factory, that's how the abstract class foo means to produce instances for you.
Yeah.
So it acts purely as an interface. So you refer to, which means that you can write your code referencing list or something. You don't have to pollute it with details of whatever mutable quantum mechanical list or whatever implementation. You can do that, but you can avoid doing that. And so most Dart users of a library really see the clean interfaces or the classes that define those interfaces now. So that's working rather well altogether.
So, I mean, I'm a fan of Dart. I can kind of be that should be clear. But one of the things that did disappoint me a little bit is that the type system I think is super interesting, but the control flow is a little bit like you said you didn't want to be adventurous, but I think the control flow is kind of boring. Yeah, and especially if you market it as a web programming language, there you would expect if I want to do asynchronous programming, for example, then I'm still kind of thrown in the callback hell.
As I said, employment of programming language designers is an important topic, and we need to have stuff to do down the line. But seriously, we have not yet really tackled that problem, right? The goal with the current mechanism was to put in the basics so that we'd have the plumbing on which higher level stuff could be put in. So it's very basic right now. Isolates have ports, and you can send to ports, and you can write methods that therefore what you get back from these operations, it's asynchronous, so you get back futures. We have futures libraries and stuff, but there's nothing like async in C# or promise pipelining or any of these alternatives, right? And which alternative we'll go with, we will eventually go with something, I'm pretty sure, but we're not there yet. We're putting in basic infrastructure. So at some point, this may change, and there's a whole bunch of ideas ranging from C# style async, which I have very mixed feelings about. I mean, it's obviously attractive, this illusion of sequential programming, but it's also, I think, a little dangerous. Promise pipelining works better in even more dynamic settings because control flow, if control messages are actually method invocations, you can do better with promise pipelining. You can get past the ifs and things like that. So we haven't decided. I even have some novel ideas of something that's not quite as radical as async, but in the direction which is basically based, it's based on a future monad, but
wow, it took almost 25, 30 minutes to hear monad.
But of course, no one needs to know that. And in fact, the more I say it, the less likely. Just the mention
of
the word.
Yes, exactly. So now we've kind of killed the idea here. Yeah. You know, like beautiful flowers, kind of cut off at the roots.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, that's okay. Nobody will need to, you know, you don't need... The thing about monads, right, there are, it's an abstract concept.
Yeah.
Maybe Eric knows of cases which I'm not aware of, but what it's very hard to find is a case where, yeah, there's lots of examples. This is a monad, that's a monad. And what good did it do me to know this? Generally, as a user, it did me no good whatsoever, right? It's not like there are all these libraries that work on arbitrary monads that do interesting stuff. Maybe you know some in Haskell, but it's pretty rare, as far as I can see, that you know, having, say, an interface monad, the monad abstraction, the type class monad, something that works only on that, that does useful work. So it's helpful to me that all these things were all defined as monads, and I can write this polymorphic code for all monads. I'm not sure that really is there. I mean,
I would disagree a little bit with that. I think it's not super useful. There's not a lot of really generic code like that. But I think the problem is that most type systems are not able to express the monad interface because it's a higher kinded type. So it's a type that's not parameterized by a type, but by a type constructor. Mm-hmm. And so most languages cannot express that. But in Haskell, there's various operators that are very useful that work on any monad. For example, you have a list of monadic computations, and you want to turn that into a monadic computation of lists. So that's like a transpose operator where you kind of, you know, you run the effects, you know, in the list, and then you accumulate the result, and then the result is an effectful computation. So there are definitely kind of higher level operations on monadic programs.
And of course, the nice thing in a dynamic language, you can write that piece of code which you actually want to write, for example, for futures. That's a very common scenario.
Yes, yeah.
And you can write that without ever hearing of what a monad is, because all that mattered is that you know about whatever you call them, chain or whatever the names you attach to these things. Of course, the Haskell community, having a great imagination, came up with these bizarre and useless names like return and whatever.
Bind and return. Well, they're better than the category theory.
ADA. Right. GAG. Yeah. Oh, GAG. Bind, GAG. I get confused. But anyway, you can write that. You can write that interface. It isn't statically typed, so it doesn't have to need to know that it's a higher order constructor. But it's just these operations, and they will work. And that you can explain to anybody. On the other hand, you know, monads and category theory. Yeah, good luck with that. It just isn't a construct that I expect to see widely articulated. You just can't explain it to people. And so, yeah, maybe you're right. There are a few of those that actually would be useful. But if you get rid of the types, all the complexity goes away. And that's indeed the case with this particular use of composing futures to do a series of async operations, which, again, is an idea that we might, you know, I have this proposal, and as long as I don't say it's connected to monads, it might actually get in, but who knows.
So what might help is that in C# tasks, which are like, I hope that I don't step on anybody's toes and, you know, insult people, that they're kind of like futures, but tasks are actually co-monads. So maybe, you know, you can, instead of saying...
That makes it all better.
Yeah, that makes it all better, yeah.
Why didn't you say so? I would embrace it in a moment, yeah.
Yeah. Well, the thing is, and so but maybe that might be interesting, because the difference is in the way you compose them. So when you have a computation, the monadic computation, then the continuation takes the result of the monadic computation. Mm-hmm. So you have to kind of first run the computation, and then you can kind of take what it produced and continue. With the co-monad, with task, the continuation takes the task itself. Mm-hmm. And then it gets, you know, that when the task has terminated, you can access it, but the task might have other contexts, like whether it failed or succeeded or so on. So, and by not giving it the result of the computation, but the kind of computation itself, you get a richer way of composing.
Okay. Yeah. This is all so much easier without the types, isn't it? Because then you can actually focus on what it does instead of all this. Continuation's another good one. I've gotten so much trouble commenting on these things, right? It just seems to me that there's a real gap between the theoretical practice, if you will, and the reality, and it reaches a point where it's a problem, right? Mathematics, classical, a lot of classical mathematics was derived hand in hand with physics. Even mathematicians don't like to admit that these days either.
No, but
right?
It's true. Yep.
And once you allow this disconnect to form, you're liable to get in trouble. So I have been rather unpopular in certain cycles by criticizing the excessive reliance on these concepts and this terminology, right? Because mathematicians love to explain things backwards, right? Because it all fits so wonderfully. Of course, it fits because it was designed to fit, but that would be beneath them to generally comment on. And we really, I think this is a point where sometimes types are useful because they help understanding, they document what you're doing. In these scenarios, they are making things harder for people to follow. There's a lot of intellectual baggage that you're forcing people to swallow that they're not ready to. And again, unless you see a real case where it really is directly applied, which there are very few, then you're better off not talking about it. It's like rope in a hanged man's house, right? Don't mention the monad and you'll be better off.
So I agree with you, but to a large extent, yeah. I think a lot of times people use types as like some smoke curtain to kind of hide their lack of understanding even. So it causes lack of understanding, but sometimes they also use it to hide their own lack of understanding. But in this case, right, like when you have a future, you have to be able to talk about the components of the future or, what happens, the thing that kind of,
Who's driving whom? Yeah, which direction?
So how do you then express that? I mean, I use the word continuation in the sense that, this is the thing that consumes the result of the future. But we do have to have some terminology or not. You cannot call it thingy and wingy.
You'd be surprised how far you can go that way. You work in industry. You should have known by now that, thingy is the all-purpose concept. But fair enough. All I'm saying is that I think these terms are overindulged in, and what did you call it? The hype graph, right?
Yeah, the hype curve.
I think some of this stuff is past its best buy date. It gets overemphasized and it's not helping.
Yeah, so one of the things, like a few weeks ago, was at the Go Tonights in Chicago. There will be a Go To in Chicago as well, and I think in April. And I was there with Rich Hickey, and we were talking about continuations. And we mentioned continuations just now. And you reacted kind of, what's the thing with continuations? Why are they so hard?
I think, again, it's very similar to the monad case. It's a mathematician's abstraction. It's not the abstraction that programmers actually want or need, right? The abstraction that programmers really want or need and that they can relate to is something concrete like the caller or the stack. And sure, part of that isn't the continuation because part of it is past, but it's also your path to the future.
Yes.
But it's something you can put your hands on. It's something real that you can relate to, and it's something that that is already divided into useful pieces. So, if continuations aren't bad enough, we have delimited continuations where things really get interesting, and that is something that's very hard for people to relate to. But on the other hand, stack frames, okay, I have my caller, it has a caller, I can go up 3 levels, 5 levels, 20 levels, I can always decide to stop. When I'm at, and I know what context I'm in, and it has a name because it's associated with a method, with something in my code. It's not some mathematical abstraction. And a mirror, a reflective system that lets you traffic in those is really useful. That's why, for example, Squeak, Smalltalk, has a seaside framework for web programming that did this continuation-style web interaction without calling it that, without anyone having to know that. And it works perfectly, and they didn't need to add anything to the system to do it because it was all already there.
But aren't we just now like bike shedding? I mean, it's like whether you call it like stack mirrors or continuations, they are the same thing. That's what a continuation is, right? It's a first-class representation of your stack.
In reality, it's always a delimited one because even the schemers stop it at the REPL or whatever, right? It's never, the And so it's the delimited one you want, it's the fine-grained control you want, and you might as well talk about that, you know, rather than this strange idea of call CC. You know, this is not an intuitive notion. And I think, but generally, programming languages is derived from computer science in general. It's come out of mathematics. And so it has a certain cultural history, and it makes a lot of sense because mathematics is how you actually figure things out. But elements of programming languages that have to do with, you know, I'd say psychology, cognitive science, design, you know, things that speak to people, are woefully neglected. And we really should be focusing on this sort of UI of these things a lot more. So the fact that it's mathematically equivalent is irrelevant. This is a useful API that gives you the right structure, the right granularity that you can actually implement fairly easily. You can control its properties fairly easily. It doesn't have to be very expensive. You can control its security, all kinds of things like that. And so, you know, it's just a better way of actually engineering the thing.
So I think what you're saying is that if you look at continuation, say, operationally, they're not kind of that complicated. One of the things that I often feel is the way people try to explain continuation, say, in Scheme, is because Scheme is an expression-based language, that makes it, I think, harder, because then it's much harder to kind of, you know, to talk about like a point in your program where, you know, there's a stack frame or where there's a call. So I agree with you. In some sense, these things are, well, I wouldn't say that they're trivial, but you can make them harder by kind of, you know, putting this kind of magical, mathematical pixie dust on them.
But it has huge advantages. It'll make you sound smarter.
And in some sense, I would say the same holds for type system. When people talk about co and contravariance, I would bet that like 80% of the people cannot explain what contravariance actually means or kind of, you know, give a coherent explanation of that. But still, you know, they like to throw the term around.
Well, it's an interesting idea because that's, again, a perfect example where the mathematical truth conflicts with people's intuition. And it's not that people's intuition is correct, but unfortunately that's what we have to work with. And so it's a good idea not to rely too heavily on things that fly in the face of people's intuition.
But do you think that there's no role at all for mathematical abstractions in programming?
Oh, of course there's a huge role. The question is you have to know when to keep your mouth shut about them and when to stop taking them as religion, right? So I don't know how you feel about this, but a big thing in the functional programming language community is, you know, we have mathematical-like notation. This is one of the worst ideas ever. Mathematical notation doesn't scale. Mathematical notation works because, you know, people write little proofs by hand, and we already violate a lot of conventions in mathematics. Things have single character identifiers, basically, which are sort of designed to actually hide what they're doing so you don't let your intuition mislead you. Whereas once you scale it up to programming, it's important to have meaningful identifiers. Generally, the whole notation, you know, is not particularly well suited to this, and it shouldn't be a goal to emulate it, right? It's, again, one of those cases where tradition and habit is, for certain people, overtaking it. But, you know, it would be good to think about what notation really works for this stuff.
So I'm a little bit like schizophrenic about that, because on the one hand, I do like, for example, Haskell, the kind of, you know, the very concise, clean mathematical notation. On the other hand, it also leads to excesses where people write things in point-free style where it looks like token soup and you have no clue what it means. On the other hand, if you look at most other programming languages, including Dart or Java or C#, curly braces and so on, it's still not very human-friendly. So maybe COBOL kind of style or Visual Basic style syntax, is that any better? Smalltalk has a similar kind of...
It took you that long to arrive at the one true answer. It is better, arguably. What really happens is that people are creatures of habit, and the familiar is always the best. So once people have been exposed to a certain notation at a certain age and gotten used to it, it's very hard to get them off of it. And they will invent all kinds of arguments why. But if you actually look at it systematically, there's real arguments for that kind of notation. And I wish when we did speak about syntax, we focused on those aspects. But usually it's either a matter of religion or it's a matter of bike shedding, where it's talking about that to avoid talking about things that are more.
So monads are over the hype curve. I think this is a perfect time to kind of, you know, throw the Gilad out before I say something that kind of I regret. So thank you very much, Gilad. It was, like, as always, like a great pleasure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thank you so much. It was great being here. Thank you.
Cheers.